This is Trepwire Week in Review for week ending November 11th, 2022. I'm Martha Kocher with Trep, a data modeling and analytics firm for the CMBS, commercial real estate, and CLO markets. I'm with Manus Clancy, Senior Managing Director, and Lonnie Henry, Head of CRE and Advisory Services. And today, Stephen Buschbaum joins us, our Director of Research. This week, midterm elections leave voters waiting for final tallies, but Republicans are likely to narrowly take the House while the Senate is still up for grabs. Earlier this week, the tech sector dragged markets down with layoff announcements and poor outlooks, but we saw a surge in markets Thursday after the release of a consumer inflation number that was cooler than expected. Manus, as we head into a long weekend with the Veterans Day holiday, a turnaround in markets with the CPI print.
The week started with the long anticipated midterm elections. Martha, as you mentioned, it looks like we'll have a split decision when things are done. Certainly, of course, the presidency will remain with the Democrats, and the House and Senate will be closely divided as they've been before. The impact on commercial real estate remains to be seen, but if the last 2 years were any indication, we may not see a lot of anything change. We may not see a lot of meaningful legislation getting passed, and whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, it remains to be seen. My only personal takeaway from the election was one of deep, deep regret, and that is being in South Carolina and being near the Georgia border, and the fact that there's now a runoff means a lot more advertisement during NFL football on Sundays for the two candidates that are standing. And I was looking forward to the end of political advertisement season, but it seems like I got another 30 days to go. The bigger news, I guess, this week was that CPI number today, which was really earth-shaking in terms of its reaction. The Dow today up, I don't know, 1,200 points, give or take, which was a modest move compared to the tech market, which surged more than 7%. So the Dow was up 3 to 4%, the NASDAQ more than 7%. So people are looking at this as an inflection point. We were bound to get here at some point. At some point, we were going to get to peak inflation. At some point, the numbers were going to level off or come down. Whether this is a statistical blip or the beginning of the turnaround remains to be seen. The markets certainly believed that this was the beginning of the end for aggressive Fed rate hikes. The odds of a 75 basis point hike in December just collapsed. The yield on the 10-year Treasury dropped 30 basis points today. It is now well under 4% at this point. I believe the yield on the 2-year dropped more than 40 basis points today. So just seismic moves. Aside from the election, which we said it's really hard to judge what the impact will be on CRE, the CPI number, the impact on CRE, should this hold, should these lower interest rates and the sentiment hold, should be immediate. You're talking about a 40 or 50 basis point drop in refinancing rates on 10-year fixed rate paper immediately, and that should turn what were cuspy assets before in terms of likelihood of being able to refinance into less cuspy today. So that's a good turn. You know, does it hold or not? We'll see.
Yeah, man, there's a lot to digest this week. I mean, there's a lot of news. We'll cover a lot of the stories, the headline stories. You know, it's interesting. There's some good news. I think the inflation number obviously coming down is good news. But if you take a step back and look at it, like, is it really good news? I mean, is 7.7 that much better than 8.2%? You know, it's still significantly higher than the target inflation rate. If you look at how it's comprised, we've talked about this before, the shelter component increased 0.8%. A lot of people would say it's historical in nature and we're starting to see rents decline, but it's still showing up as, you know, an increase month over month. And I think, you know, we're kind of falling victim to this month-to-month mindset in the markets where, you know, everyone's waiting for the Fed to release what they're going to do with rates. We're waiting for CPI numbers. And then there's an immediate reaction to both of those occurrences. And we kind of take that as an overall reaction to the news, positive or negative. But in reality, you know, I don't know if any of us finish the year at 7.7% inflation, if we're cheering that that's really great news in the grand scheme of things in the longer term, you know, even medium term horizon. So I agree with you. We've hit the inflection point. Inflation peaked around 9%. So we're down, you know, 1.3% from the high. But I don't know necessarily. I guess we'll wait and see till the next report if there's a precipitous drop off over the next couple of months, or if it holds steady at 7.7, if gas prices come back up after the midterms because we stop releasing oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, like there's other things I think that are still unknown. You know, some of the composition of this was due to the used car market. I think the used car market and car sales really plummeted on price. And so that's potentially good news. There's been some chatter on Twitter this week around Carvana and maybe if they're even viable going forward. And if that, you know, bomb drops and maybe they are proven not to be viable and there's some sort of a bankruptcy or liquidation there, you know, the used car market could see a significant overhaul in terms of pricing. So I think a lot to digest there. You know, there were some other stories this week, though, like Bloomberg had a story that highlighted about 37% of small businesses were unable to pay rent, their full rent in October. 49% of restaurants were unable to pay their full rent this month. And on the restaurant side, that was up from about 36% in September. And then I think the other big headline story today, which we can have a little discussion around, is FTX. You know, if you've been off the grid for a couple of days and haven't seen what's going on there, I mean, basically, they've been proven to be insolvent. The founder was trying to raise about $4 billion in equity to try to, you know, prevent a liquidity shortfall. I think I read today, later this afternoon, where he's actually either filed bankruptcy or is on the brink of that. So interesting to see that, you know, at one point that company was valued at about $32 billion. They raised significant capital, and not just from some no-name folks. I mean, these are institutional-grade firms that have, that plowed, you know, real money into this and effectively is insolvent at this point. Also, some professional athletes. Tom Brady, been a rough week and a half or 2 weeks for Tom. He lost to the Carolina Panthers. He lost a supermodel wife, and now he's lost about $400 million or something in FTX. So not laughing at Tom. It's been a rough week, but a lot of headlines, a lot of stories. I think we'll get into some of the layoffs and some of the other stuff here. But I don't know if you have any thoughts on the FTX, if the Bannis Clancy bank account's been impacted negatively with the demise of FTX.
Well, just taking a step back, because this is a commercial real estate show, why don't you define for us, Lonnie, what that is exactly? What did go bankrupt this week? Because it's a kind of off the beaten path a little bit.
Yeah, so it's interesting. I'm not sure I know, and I'm not sure anyone that even invested their money knows. What I think happened was the founder of FTX effectively had another sister company that was a hedge fund, and they were leveraging the capital that they had through the FTX platform or the Bitcoins, and they were actually loaning those to the sister company, and they were making YOLO type of bets in the market, and became insolvent. They lost the money. And so I think at this point, there's questions around if all that was even above board, if they were actually using their investors' money in a way that they weren't supposed to by leveraging that and then letting their research company or hedge fund actually make stock bets and other things in the market. And so I think what we're seeing here is, you know, and I'm clearly not smart enough. I haven't put any money in Bitcoin because I don't understand Bitcoin, and everyone I ask to explain it to me, I think it becomes clearer and clearer that they don't understand Bitcoin. I've gone to a couple of conferences that have walked through the blockchain, which I think is kind of, you know, what the Bitcoin is a byproduct of. And blockchain makes sense. Like having a fully transparent, you know, unchangeable ledger of events makes sense. But this, you know, derivative of that using some sort of crypto-based or technology-based currency, I don't think anyone fully understands that. Martha and I talked this week, and there were some Twitter comments where someone asked someone if they could explain this to them like they were a 65-year-old, and they're instead of a 5-year-old, and the responses were really, really interesting.
I'll turn this around just a little bit, and thank you for that explanation, because I was looking for any explanation whatsoever to get my arms around what was really happening. I do know that, you know, the turmoil this week sent crypto down, I think 16 or 20% in one day, all the turmoil there. So, and the company we're talking about is a crypto brokerage house, I guess, or exchange, you would call it. But we've mentioned this many times on the podcast that when you have this kind of volatility, it's rarely the first event that triggers a liquidity crisis. It's who was lending to this organization, who was putting their money in the hedge fund, and what other derivative or secondary impacts will you see? And that was some of the things. I don't spend a lot of time on Twitter, but that seemed to be the speculation this week, right? Some people were calling this the long-term capital moment, that we're going to find that somebody was financing these hedge funds, and all of a sudden they are going to be holding the bag, so to speak, right? They're going to be underwater, or the credit will no longer be good, and it may take time for that to play out. But before we move on to the next segment, you know, you talked about a couple of negative things with Tom Brady. I got to throw in that last one, which you neglected to say, which kind of I found stunning given our conversation from a month ago. He bought a pickleball team, and so did LeBron. Several athletes, I think maybe Kevin Durant did too. That was just mind-boggling to me. I'd love to hear from our listeners. Is that a green shoot, a market top, crabgrass?
He might need a new advisor, actually. I think, honestly, let's ask Tom. We would be happy to advise him going forward.
Before we move on to the next thing, Stephen, I know you were looking at some of the rent stuff in the CPI number today. Anything really jump out at you in the parsing of the report this morning?
Yeah, it did. And one number in particular stuck out to me. The shelter cost, while it only accounts for roughly one third of the all item index, it was responsible for more than half of the total increase in CPI on a monthly basis. And really what that's signaling here is that sticky inflation continues to be a problem. And if we dig in a little bit deeper into the shelter costs, that's comprised of two main components, right? The owner's equivalent rent and traditional apartment type rents. And the owner's equivalent saw some cooling, which was nice to see. And we've seen that in some of the other data points from S&P Case-Shiller and NAR and a number of other data points recently showing some cooling in single family residential, which you're going to expect when mortgage rates are above 7%. And so that's telling you really all that strength was coming truly from apartment rent growth, right? And we're seeing some cooling there on that front. But in my mind, I just think, gosh, when is this going to give up? When are we going to see enough construction deliveries, job losses, something to cool off that part of the market? Because right now it is painful. And in areas like New York, it's just consuming a lot of your consumers, you know, take home pay.
Yeah, it would seem like that would be the one segment of the economy that could keep the CPI number from retreating at a faster pace, right?
Correct.
That and probably service expenses, right? Those are the two big parts of these numbers that tend to be sticky, right? Once rents go up, they rarely go down. Once wages go up, they rarely go down. So, you know, that may be the kind of thing that makes this kind of a slow trickle lower than kind of a really sharp decline over the next 12 months. We'll see.
A good tool for our listeners out there is the Atlanta Fed provides this sticky CPI tool. And we will hopefully have this in a blog piece coming up in the next week, talking about, you know, the rent CPI numbers when we dig in and do a little bit deeper analysis here. And that sticky CPI tool really gives you some simple, clean insight into behind the numbers, some of the things that are being talked about at the Fed. And so looking at the CPI print today, you know, what I'm watching going forward for December's comments, you know, the market rallied today, undoubtedly so, right, as you would expect. But what I think we want to be cautious about is not thinking, oh, this gives the Fed all the ammunition, you know, a reason to pivot, pause, or just become dovish here. Really, what I think the Fed will be looking for is what's in the jobs and wage growth numbers, right? This was obviously what they want to see and expect to see, given how far we've come on a rate hike basis. But until we start seeing wage cooling and, you know, ultimately some cracks in the labor market, I don't think they want to look anything like the 1970s, 80s Fed that turned dovish too early and ultimately ended up hiking rates further than they would have had to if they had stayed the course. You know, and that's really, I think a big takeaway is that, yeah, we are likely to see 50 basis points if we start seeing some job losses and cracks in the labor market. I'd be shocked if we don't see the odds of a 25 basis point hike in December, but I am not looking for any dovish comments at all, because what the Fed doesn't want to see is inflation expectations staying.
All right, there we go. Stephen on record. No dovish comments coming from the Fed next month. We'll check in with you next month, Stephen, and make sure that we keep you honest.
Yeah, I really had to polish my crystal ball for that one.
Manus, you talked about the elections and the effect on the CRE market. We might not know that for a few weeks, obviously, until the results are finalized. We do have Mike Flood from the MBA that's going to join us next week to help us deconstruct some of that. But, you know, Manus, the conventional wisdom usually is that gridlocked Washington is good for the markets, meaning they can't do any real damage. What about this time with the type of economy we have right now?
Well, I look back on the last 2 years, and it was very hard, even though the Democrats had control of both houses and the presidency, of course. It was a real challenge for them to get anything meaningful done. They did get a few things done. I think it's going to be more of the same. I think gridlock is the right word. They might get a few things done, but I think it will be very tricky for any real major legislation to go through. You know, time will tell, but it was really hard, even though they had that tiebreaker in the Senate and they had a majority in the House. You know, keeping people in line and pulling things over the finish line was really tough. And that's not going to get any easier. So I think gridlock is the word, and only modest changes is probably the outcome we'll see.
So we invite listeners to tune in next week when we have Mike help us break that down. We had a number of earnings and corporate announcements this week, and you talked about having to see some layoffs to take the pressure off wages. We did see a lot of that this week.
Yeah, so Wells Fargo actually had an announcement. We're starting to see some cracks, 18,000 loans in their retail origination pipeline in the early weeks of the fourth quarter. It's down 90% from a year earlier. They haven't announced layoffs, but I think if you read between the lines there, based on what they have in terms of pipeline, they're coming. Redfin did announce some layoffs, so they said they're going to shut down their home flipping business. We've seen the same from Zillow a few months ago. I think Opendoor, which is another, you know, home flipping business, their stock's been significantly impacted negatively. But Redfin's laying off about 13% of its workforce, 862 employees. If we look at Rocket Mortgage, again, they haven't announced layoffs directly, but if you look at their earnings, they had a 90% drop from the earnings last year. So if you look at just those three or four companies, we're going to start seeing some significant downturn on the mortgage side. Meta, some of the tech companies, they're a little more finite in terms of the layoffs. Meta laid off 11,000 people, 13% of its workforce. They're shrinking their office footprint, which we've talked about, you know, over the last couple of weeks. Twitter grabbed the headlines early in the week. They laid off about 3,800 employees. Elon Musk followed that up saying they were forced to do that because Twitter's losing about $4 million a day. Lyft was another company, laid off about 600 plus employees. That was from a November 3rd Securities and Exchange filing. And then I mentioned it earlier, Carvana stock is down almost 50% since it's announced its quarterly earnings last week. And so I think there's going to be some definite reduction in staff coming there too, based on their performance. Salesforce was another one. So, I mean, their list is pretty exhaustive. None of these numbers in sum total amount to, you know, a significant number outside of maybe Meta at 11,000. But I think what we'll see is the knock-on effects now that some of these bigger players have started pulling the trigger and laying people off. I would assume we'll start seeing some of these other, you know, tech adjacent firms doing the same on their payrolls as well.
Yeah. One of the other headlines we saw today, WeWork missed on its numbers. It announced it was going to be closing 40 offices. For those that receive our daily Tripwire reports, we've been really trying to keep on top of these. They've announced a lot of lease terminations over the last 2 years. A lot of their offices were represented in CMBS. They back CMBS loans. And so this is something that we've been watching very carefully and will continue to watch.
So turning to real estate earnings, more than half of the REITs have reported results at this point. And Stephen is going to take a look at what those results brought us so far. Walk us through how they're faring this quarter.
The storyline for third quarter REIT earnings is very similar to what we had in the second quarter, in that a majority of REITs have beaten consensus estimates, raised or narrowed forward guidance, and had a lot of positive comments across the board about leasing activity, revenue growth, and, you know, we started to see some comments about concerns going forward. On a sector level basis, the best performing sectors have been industrial in terms of both beating consensus estimates and funds from operations year-over-year growth. On average, they've beaten consensus estimates by 6% and posted average year-over-year FFO growth of 26% for that sector. Office has beaten consensus by, on average, 4%, and funds from operations on a year-over-year basis, on average, have grown by 7%. And then for residential space and retail space, those sectors have beaten consensus estimates by a little bit more than 1%. Residential REITs, on average, have seen year-over-year funds from operations growth of 15%, and retail has seen year-over-year FFO growth of 9%. In terms of geographic trends, the Sunbelt markets continue to be the best performing areas, benefiting very much from the migration away from higher cost of living, higher crime areas. And then coastal markets, much like we've seen the tech wreck in the stock market, well, the coastal markets have reflected much of that shakiness. So with that, let's dig into the office REIT sector. So let's start off first with Alexandria Real Estate Trust. They beat the consensus estimate by 0.5% with third quarter earnings of 2.13 cents per share. So they had a good revenue boost from the prior year, up about $100 million, beating consensus estimate on the top line by 3.3%. Turning to Boston Properties, they beat consensus estimate by 2.1%, coming in with FFO of 1.91 cents per share. That's up 10.4% on a year-over-year basis. So really strong activity there. And digging in just a little bit onto their income statement, they had revenues or top line growth of 3.6% on a year-over-year basis. Same property NOI was up 9.3%. So really strong activity. Turning now to Kilroy Realty. They beat consensus estimates on FFO by 2.6%. with FFO of 1.17 cents per share. That is up 19.4% on a year-over-year basis. So really strong activity there. Looking at their income statement, they had revenues up on a year-over-year basis and beating consensus on the top line by 4.35%. Next up, we have Vornado. This was one that was, I'd say, mostly positive. So they had FFO beating consensus estimate of 9.5%. And on a year-over-year basis, FFO was up 14.1%. They beat revenues estimates as well, with year-over-year growth of about $20 million or so. Next, we're going to turn to Cousins, so a Sunbelt office operator. They beat consensus with FFO of 0.69 cents per share. That's a beat of 4.5%. On a year-over-year basis, they were effectively flat. And so this was consistent with what we saw last quarter from them. A bit of a mixed bag, some positives, some negatives. Next, we have Highwood. This was one of the real strong points, at least when you dig through the numbers a little bit. Highwood's properties beat consensus by 7.2%, and FFO was up on a year-over-year basis, 8.3%. Now, what was interesting was, they beat on the top line, but the comments from the CEO, they were able to lease over 1 million square feet of second generation office space. It's highest new leasing volume since 2014, with net effective rents that were more than 20% above the prior 5-year average. And importantly, they substantially backfilled their largest 2023 lease expiration.
In sharp contrast to some of the other REIT guys in terms of looking forward, right? You said that they were very positive and upbeat. They had a great tailwind this last year, and they've covered some of their 2023 pending vacancies. Not so much the story with Boston Properties, and I think it was Vornado. Boston Properties was pretty blunt about the headwinds being very strong. And Vornado, I think they're pulling the plug, at least temporarily, on their Penn Station project.
So I think there was a couple of other things here, Stephen. If we step back and look beyond just this quarter's reported earnings, if you look on the macro, like year-to-date performance has actually not been great, it seems like, for the REITs at large. So there was some data in Seeking Alpha this week where it said, there was a strong recovery in October, but REITs on the whole remain deeply in the red for 22, with about a 21% negative total return year to date. Contrast that with the quarter return of about 9% in October. Still not great news on the whole for the year. It's interesting to see, and I don't know that we will have the answer to this. It's great that you could kind of highlight one of the REITs that maybe had some success with the office leasing. But to Manus's point, it seems like the overarching trend that we've seen is that a lot of these operators still haven't quite figured out how to fill the space. What is that new prevailing market rent? Do they have assets or do they have development plans that they're not going to be able to fulfill or reposition or whatever? So I would say from my perspective, it's great news for the quarter. And it seems like some REITs definitely outperformed. But I think on the whole, it almost leaves me with a little more questions than answers in terms of, you know, are these current asset values or the REITs, their current trading value, is that indicative of what the market truly sees for them on a go-forward basis? Or do we really not know based on some of the other market uncertainty? Like, I don't know if interest rates have truly been priced in at this point. I think there's a lot of questions that we could probably ask ourselves and just monitor over the next couple of quarters as it pertains to the REIT market in general.
Yeah, that's a great point, Lonnie. And I got a really interesting data point about a month ago that I think will speak very much to that. Before I get to that just a little bit there, I see the exact same thing that you're talking about, the price earnings multiple. So their valuation, effectively, they've been hit very, very hard in the market. They're considered an interest rate sensitive sector. And so, yes, stock investors have beaten them down very hard. And when we look at, you know, some of the more fundamental cap rate type analysis, specifically the data point I got about a month ago was that if we look at the typical cap rate spread to interest rates and the net asset value discount, right, what investors are pricing in, that approximately two-thirds of the pain was really priced in to their values, right? And so, you know, we've been a little bit frustrated that the cap rate data hasn't reflected the interest rate increases to the extent many of us thought. And right, some of that's the data lags and just the selectivity of what does trade in this sort of a market. You know, to hear that, you know, two-thirds was baked in to stock prices was really reassuring to me. And thought, well, that's markets functioning in the end. Because when you see the leasing activity, they're able to refinance, you know, the performing assets, right? The market's still functioning. That narrative holds, and the underlying is not as bad as what it looks like on the surface.
All right, so let's turn to the office sector. Manus, you mentioned Vornado regarding the Penn Station. That was a story this week in the Wall Street Journal that talked about the fact that developers are pausing on some of their work to see where the headwinds take them, and they specifically quoted CEO Stephen Roth from Vornado saying he was cautious about that particular project. It sounds like the demolition will continue, but he did not really answer the fact as to whether the build out for the building that they were going to put on that property would continue.
Yeah, it's not an easy thing right now to put things up on spec, right? In the past, they've done big projects at the post office by Penn Station, knowing in advance that they had Facebook lined up. You know, I think many developers in this environment will be very hesitant to put something up without a bona fide anchor tenant in place to begin with. I mean, I think people can still get away with that in the industrial space right now, but I think doing it in offices, especially in places where return to office has been lagging, New York and San Francisco and other places, I think that's a challenge. So we'll see.
And did I mention that was a Peter Grant story? So if I didn't mention Peter, we know him well.
Old friend Peter Grant, yes. We had a lot of office stories this week. I won't dwell on any one of them, but I'll run through them very quickly. The first one, a green shoot from Commercial Property Executive. This comes from Jordana Rothberg. Morgan Stanley has extended and expanded its space at the Thames Street Wharf in Baltimore. Amanda Hoffler owns that particular property. The firm had 200,000 square feet. They've committed to another 50,000 square feet, and they will occupy that space through 2035. So Baltimore, you know, not a great story over the last 10 years in terms of their office tenancy. They've lost some major anchors and Fortune 500 firms This is a really terrific story there. In the Brokers Start Your Engines category, this story from Bloomberg, the writers there, Max Reyes and Isis Almeida. Allstate is in talks to come back to Chicago from the suburbs. You may recall that they sold their headquarters in the Chicago suburbs a few months ago. They're looking to get back into Chicago. Brokers shouldn't get overly excited because 75% of their employees do work from home. So it may not be the square footage that one was hoping for a firm of that size. More green shoots in the Bay Area. This comes from George Avalos of the Bay Area News Group. In Sunningvale, 200 South Matilda Street sold for $193 million. That is a building occupied by Uber, if I remember correctly. And from Danny Ecker of Crane Chicago, a frequent writer that we source in our podcast, he reported today that Morningstar has decided to stay at its office. It is renewed for 5 years for 260,000 square feet at 22 West Washington. So those are our green shoots. And then I'll get to, unfortunately, what are some plentiful crabgrasses as well.
I just have an anecdotal comment, not related directly to those stories, but I did see today where Elon Musk was saying the Twitter employees that remain employed are going to have to be 40 hours a week in the office. So I think that may be a playbook that gets replicated across some of these other companies, where if you have some layoffs and there's a little bit of fear among the employees about stability of their employment, the employer is going to have some leverage to get them back in the office. So it's good to see some people coming back to Chicago. But when 75% of their employees are still remote, as you highlighted there, Manus, you know, they're not really fully occupying or leveraging that space. But potentially this maybe opens the door for them to take a little firmer stance on getting people back in the office.
And I think what'll be interesting to see is how many of those employees left and went to a different city in anticipation of continued work from home trends. And so if we do see some return back to office for employees that want to stay, you know, at Twitter, Meta, the like, you know, we could see some downward pressure on the work from home cities that kind of benefited from that shift.
Moving on to some crabgrass. This is from the Washington Business Journal's Dan Brendel. One of our listeners had asked us to keep track of this story 5 or 6 months ago, and we have as a result. The U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, which is in Alexandria, Virginia, is only going to renew for two-thirds of its square footage. The tenant, I believe, is the largest GSA tenant in the entire U.S. They have 2.4 million square feet in Alexandria. Their lease was to end in 2024. They're going to renew 1.6 million square feet and renew that for only another 5 years. So not a great story there. In Washington, the SEC confirmed that it will let one of its three DC offices leases lapse. This comes from Tristan Navera. They have leases at Station Place 1, 2, and 3 in DC that expire in 2023. That's near Union Station. They've been rumored for a long time to be looking to build a new 1.3 million square foot headquarters outside of DC. The SEC confirmed this week that at Station Place 3, they will not be renewing. That's at 700 2nd Street Northeast. The impact there is meaningful for CMBS potentially. That property, Station Place 3, backs a $190 million CMBS loan. The SEC occupies 40% of that 500,000 square foot office. And as I said, the lease ends in 2023. In Denver, this comes from Greg Avery of the Denver Business Journal. ULA has reduced its footprint in Centennial by 150,000 square feet. They will not be renewing their office at 7968 South Chester. That building is also known as Waterview 4. In Houston, this comes from The Real Deal. A story there said that Houston office subleases are now coming in at 25 to 75% discounts to asking rents of a couple months ago. And they also pointed out that these leases are not really in off the beaten path offices. They're really kind of class B plus or better office space where people can get 40, 50, 60% discounts. And lastly, in Cleveland, this is Sean McDonald, Medical Mutual will be leaving downtown Cleveland and will be moving to Brooklyn, Ohio. The firm will be consolidated in that Brooklyn office in January. MM has about 250 employees at the Rose Building on East 9th Street in Cleveland. They've been there for 75 years. So an awful lot of green and crab this week.
Yeah, a couple of quick comments, Manus. On the DC lease there, Station Place 3, that one was an interesting story because the current landlord actually had a lawsuit that they had filed to try to prevent the SEC from being able to move. And it looks like that lawsuit was dismissed in September, which is going to allow them to vacate. So that was one that had a little bit of hair on it. And then the stuff in Houston, you know, 25 to 75% discount. I don't know if we have a more dynamic, not in a positive way, dynamic in the sense of just ever-changing market than the Houston office market. I mean, it depends. It's like the Texas weather. There's a joke here in Texas, like if you don't like the weather, wait 5 minutes and it'll change. So as an example, this week it's been 70 degrees. This weekend we're supposed to have lows in the 20s. So that's kind of how it rolls here. But in the Houston market, when oil and gas is good and the market's strong, those leases drive long terms, high rents. When it's down though, man, it's really down. 25 to 75% discount for sublease space on, you know, non-ancillary or secondary buildings is a pretty big hit to that market. It'll be interesting to see how that actually plays out.
Yeah, so an anecdotal data point I got recently out of Lubbock on that oil and gas strength, and this one was interesting to me because, you know, in 2008, Lubbock didn't really see the same level of price declines that you saw around the country. And this was true for Dallas, Houston. The oil wealth kind of offset some of the typical housing price losses we saw across the rest of the country. Well, this time around, it's a little bit different. And specifically, my friend's whose wife works for a home builder there, and he was admittedly very highly leveraged, his business completely shut down. And he's had to lay off a substantial portion of his workforce. And I've been told that, you know, effectively nothing's trading. It is rough out there. And so even though we've seen, you know, oil strength that we would have thought would have benefited that area, that hasn't been the case.
Yeah, I think we're going to see, I mean, continued really significant declines on the residential side. I mean, single family mortgages going from 3% to 7.5% in a matter of a few months. I mean, that market's come to a complete stop. In fact, I actually started getting some emails this week from my real estate business where apartment locators are actually being compensated again and sought after by apartment leasing agents and the leasing management companies. For the last 3 or 4 years, there's been no need for them to pay locators or anyone else commissions for new tenants because they've had no shortcoming of tenants at higher rates. And just this week, we started seeing some of these larger firms sending out email blasts saying, hey, we have some locator specials if you bring us some new tenants.
And that's exactly what we saw with some of the apartment and just more generally residential REIT earnings, was that on top of the significant cooling and rent growth, it's translating to the bottom line through some occupancy fluctuations, higher leasing costs, and just in general, some cracks.
There was an article this week from RealPage where they talked about the loss to lease factors. And so, you know, that's a metric on the operating statement that we haven't seen for some time. In fact, you've probably been seeing several instances of gain to lease where they're actually renting units at above market rents. But we're starting to see that loss to lease come back where, you know, the current rents are actually above what they're signing new leases for. You know, they're going to have to start writing that down, offering concessions, doing some of these other look and lease specials and things that they haven't done in a while. I think it's interesting if you just drive, at least where I'm located, if you drive down through any of the apartment, you know, submarkets, you're starting to see the balloons, the banners, and all of the stuff that they use to try to entice people to stop by and rent their units. And that's been something that we haven't seen for some time. So it'll be very interesting to see what happens with this rental rate trajectory. It's been on the uptick for so long. I think we may not see any stabilized, you know, kind of leveling off. I think we may actually see in some markets an immediate turn and a deceleration in rents to where we're actually seeing, you know, rental declines that are measurable in certain markets.
So we have a couple of multifamily stories and we'll finish out with a student housing ranking.
Yeah, I just want to focus on one multifamily story that, you know, I would certainly call crabgrass. You know, we've seen evidence that cap rates were going up. We've seen a slowdown in transactions. I don't think we've seen a real reset in prices that would be what I call eye-opening or alarming. But we did see one this week that was kind of in that category. This comes from Real Estate Business Online's Kristen Hiller. Northland has acquired Thea at Metropolis, which is a Los Angeles apartment complex. It's a 59-story luxury tower. The owner had been Greenland Housing, which is the Greenland Housing Group, which is a Chinese organization's U.S. subsidiary. Why this got my attention was that the asset sold for just $504 million. I think the original reporting was from the Wall Street Journal. The piece says that the purchase price represented a 40 to 45% discount to replacement costs. And the journal also noted that the original asking price 18 months ago was just under $700 million. So we're talking about an almost 30% reduction in price from what they were hoping to get 18 months ago. And that is a whopping reset for that market. That is the luxury market, downtown LA, I think fairly recently developed this particular asset. And if you're looking for something, you know, that kind of reflects perhaps the canary in the coal mine, this might be it, right? We've yet to see any kind of comparable price reduction that comes anywhere close to a 28% number prior to this.
They feel like they're really getting an asset that's trophy in location, that's brand new in construction, highly amenitized. And while they're getting it at a discount now, they're really, you know, they think this is going to be a stable asset for them over a very long time horizon. So the CEO of Northland is actually pretty active on Twitter and has detailed this deal fairly extensively over the last week. I'd love to have him come on the pod as a guest and kind of walk us through this. Northland's been really active. They actually had an announcement a couple of weeks ago on some senior housing development that they've done. And this, I think, you know, it's interesting. $500 million asset acquisition in LA in this market, it's a pretty big number, even though it's a huge discount to the construction costs or the replacement costs. I think he said at one point they had about $4,600 average occupied rents in place. So this is a really high-end luxury. Some of their two and three bedrooms, I think, were over $10,000 a month on the rental side. So if you want a little more detail on this, you can check it out on Twitter for sure, because there's been a lot of talk about this. It's been a pretty trophy type of asset acquisition, and they're detailing the underwriting and what went into that thought process.
And to finish out this segment, student housing has been a sector that we've looked at over the last few years, and it was relatively resilient after the pandemic. And Stephen looked at what the rankings are in terms of financial stress for some of these student housing loans.
And just for some background context here, student housing was a bit of an interesting beast, right? It had an increase in delinquency in 2008, much like all other property types, but it persisted for a long time. And we saw a strong set of issuance between 2013 and 2018 in CMBS as the GSEs entered the market and took over a lot of that issuance. And so student housing was one of the subsectors that was left that was going into the conduit pools. And specifically, it tended to be a little bit more biased toward recent vintage, higher amenity type properties, right? You can imagine these would be the places that as a college student, you would absolutely love to live, you know, golf simulators, indoor pool, you name it, lots of lovely amenities, but from cost of upkeep, turnover and competitive standpoint, those are kind of risky things to have in there. Because as you can imagine, college students don't exactly always, you know, care so much about keeping things up. And with the arms race to deliver to the market, that's effectively meant it was a race to the bottom for rents. So with increasing expenses, decreasing rents, we saw a lot of delinquent student housing loans from 2008 forward. And the pandemic was an additional shock once student learning went remote. And so what we did was we looked at the state level, a few different metrics, and took a weighted average so that we could come up with our own play on the CFP college football playoff rankings. So we used delinquency, percent of loans with a debt service coverage less than 1.0, the trailing 12 occupancy, and watch list. So we rated those: delinquency at 35%, debt coverage at 30, trailing 12-month occupancy at 20%, and watch list at 15, right? To give just a holistic guide the hand a little bit for the credit analysis. What we saw was Illinois topped the list with delinquency of 5%, debt coverage less than 1.0 was 17%, and the trailing 12-month occupancy was 88%, so really not great. Tennessee was second up with, this was really one that it stuck out to me, delinquency of 13% and debt coverage less than 133%. What's interesting is that's not University of Tennessee that was driving that. That was one large loan in Johnson City, Tennessee, that was really dragging on performance there. Third up was Louisiana. Delinquency wasn't too bad relative to the national average. It was almost on par with 2.25% delinquent, 22% with a debt coverage less than one, and trailing 12 occupancy was 89%. And so some of the things that stuck out to me and sifting through some of the credit analysis was one of the really painful things for some of these universities and student housing properties was when you had lockdowns in China where we had a strong influx, say University of Chicago specifically was one that I recall reading this servicing comment. You didn't have the return of students to that market. And so what little student housing demand was left was a race to the bottom. And so it was a really, really tough hit for some of these student housing properties to try and compete without the international student demand that they had been relying on.
If you want to read that full report, check out our website. It's posted on there for you to download for free. If you have questions about that, send us an email at podcast@trep.com. Turning to shout outs, Kieran R., thanks for the podcast. It's kept me up to date on what's been going on. Dan C. listens to the podcast with great interest and interestingly wanted an episode on REITs. So I hope we gave him a little bit of a taste of that. There's a lot of information to digest there. So we covered what we could today. Rock S. seems like someone is figuring out office to resi conversion. Sent us a couple of stories of Hines, who is doing some of those types of conversions currently. Thank you for sending us those. We actually talked about that on that guest pod that we had where we solicited folks that if they had any examples to send that. So we got one. Arpit G gave us a shout out for our innovation challenge on Twitter. So thank you. And we had a number of people ask us for our quarterly data review and folks that also were interested in our risk management banking webinar that we had this week, Matt O, Christian D, Mario H, Mordecai R, and Nick N. And our friend Jan told us to keep up the great work. We have the best podcast in CRE. So thank you for that, Jan. That's very thoughtful.
So I had a couple of shout outs this week too, Martha. We had a couple of listeners reach out. Mitchell R., he's a CRE development analyst for a Salt Lake City development firm. He's fairly new to CRE, been in the space about 2 years. I was able to jump on a quick Zoom call with him. It's great to catch up with the young and hungry CRE practitioners in the marketplace. And I had one other listener reach out, Colin M. He's a mortgage loan broker in New York. Similar situation, both intrigued by the podcast and the content that we put out. And it was really exciting to talk with them. And it gives me, you know, hope for the next generation. Super sharp folks, really interested in CRE, and took the time to send us an email and spend a little bit of time with me on Zoom. So appreciate that very much.
And I'll throw out a shout out to Jay and Vishal. They do a lot of development, or a lot of buying, I should say, in the Southeast, hotels and multifamily. It was great catching up with them on the state of the market and where things are going and the impact of higher interest rates. As I've said endless times on this podcast, love the back and forth with our listener group. Just a tremendous, talented, thoughtful, and interesting group of people. And I never get tired of talking about the industry with those that really have their boots on the ground and see what's happening.
And Rohan on Twitter and Tammy G, the machine just keeps rolling. She had a number of really good comments. And as you know, it's Veterans Day tomorrow. But you may not know that a bunch of restaurants will offer you a deal, meaning free food, guys. So if you have someone you know who's a vet, and I happen to know someone in my own family, I'm going to take him to Buffalo Wild Wings. He's going to get free wings and French fries.
There you go. And let me throw out a shout out. I meant to do this in the beginning and neglected to. Just eternal thanks to all the veterans among our listeners. I know there's several that have served the country that are listeners that have gone from the military into commercial real estate. And I can't express my gratitude to your for your service strongly enough. So thank you. And I hope you enjoy this Veterans Day weekend.
And with that, we'll close. Thanks to our producer, Haley Keene. Join us next week as we all look at what's happened during the week and how it may be impacting you. If you have a question or a comment, send your email to podcast@trep.com and subscribe to the podcast with your favorite provider. Thank you for listening and stay well.
All right.